Welcome to the Slow Dive Podcast. I'm Farida, your host on this deep sea exploration of impact, creativity, and the stories that shape us. Thank you for tuning in as we submerge again, this time with the guest who embodies the power of storytelling in truly amazing ways, Ray Benjamin. Ray is a screenwriter, producer, proud LA native who has carved out a unique space in film and TV. After earning her political science degree from Loyola Marymount, she set her sights on storytelling, finding inspiration in life's awkward, uncomfortable, and often hilarious moments, the kind you might hesitate to laugh at but can't resist. Her ability to flip these moments into empathy-expanding stories has led to some impressive projects, including her recent work as a co-producer on the Netflix The Witcher and her role as co-writer and co-executive producer on the upcoming animated feature The Witcher: Sirens of the Deep. Ray is also the visionary behind In the Cut, a platform providing crucial resources and training for BIPOC creatives interested in breaking into the entertainment. Partnering with industry powerhouses like NBC Universal, Final Draft, and the Gotham Institute, Ray has built an incredible ecosystem that's already impacted hundreds through live and virtual events. When she's not shaping the future of storytelling or leading the charge for diversity in Hollywood, Ray is spending time with her son. She's rep by UTA in Redefine Entertainment, and I couldn't be more thrilled to welcome her on the Slow Dive. Hello, Ray. How are you?
Great. Thank you for that illustrious intro. You make me sound way cooler than I am, so thank you.
You are. You're welcome. It's all true, though. It's all true. And thank you for joining us. So, you're a founder, you're a creator. So many things to cover. So let's just get right in with our icebreaker questions. That's the first segment. When was the last time you felt awe?
This is going to sound very cheesy, but I feel awe like every day when I look into my son's eyes. he just turned one a couple weeks ago. And now that he's getting older, you know, he's getting a little personality. And I was just with a friend yesterday and he gave me a little hug and she was just like, oh, that's so sweet. And I'm like, I know, like I get so emotional every time he just does simple things. And I'm like, is it always going to be like this? Like he's a year and I'm still like very into this and speaking to mothers. A lot of them say, no, it just... You're just like that the rest of your life. So,
no, that is so beautiful. And yes, children and babies are a blessing. And so, yes, absolutely right. Aw. If you were not in entertainment, what field would you be in?
I think I'd be a graphic designer still. I was a graphic designer before I got into writing. I still do design. Like I basically do all the design for my business, for the website and all the social stuff. And I just like design, whether it be graphic design. I also have gotten into interior design lately, somewhere in the design realm. I just like making functional spaces that are beautiful, you know, so that's my thing.
I love that. I see how that plays into everything that you're doing, design, creativity. Yes, very much. Your current read, is there anything you're reading right now that's like to recommend?
I have a book club, actually. I started a book club, but we only read nonfiction books. Mm-hmm. So right now we're reading Mindset by Carol Dweck. I've read it before, but I recommended it to the book club, so I'm rereading it again after several years, and it's just a really great book, so recommend that one.
Great. We will link that. Mindset. Okay. Mm-hmm. I love nonfiction growth mindset books, and yeah, I think that's a good title. I haven't heard of that one, so I will definitely check it out.
It's great. It just basically talks about how there are two types of mindsets, like a growth mindset versus a fixed mindset, and how when you have a growth mindset, you're able to be more resilient and sort of pick yourself up after setbacks and keep striving forward. Even that sort of outweighs natural talent and like intellectual ability, the ability to practice essentially and to learn from failure is more important than like actual talent. And she is, I think she was a Harvard or Stanford researcher, one of those fancy places. And it's backed by actual data. Like she shows all this data and case studies of like even children who are prodigies, and people thought they were going to be the best, but they sort of all peaked around high school age, because once you get to that age, you can't just rely on pure talent. You have to basically start practicing and improving your skills. And it's a really interesting book. And I think that I actually did have a fixed mindset until I read this book. And I think I've been trying to change that over the last few years since I first read the book.
I love that. And I do think how magical books are when they come into your life, and they can be turning points. So the right book can just shift you like that. And it's a message that needs to be, So I think all of our listeners should definitely check it out, because it came through our podcast episode today. Okay, we're going to go into our first segment, which is the Intrepid Television Screenwriting Journey, Ray. What was the inspiration for you to get into television writing? Did you always want to produce stories?
I was always a writer. So I have written ever since I can remember. My mom used to like make little booklets of my short stories and poems and give them out to people as gifts when I was a kid. I went to an arts high school for creative writing, actually, but I didn't really know that screenwriting was a job, if that makes sense. Like, I feel like as kids, we all watch TV shows, we watch movies, but I wasn't thinking, oh, someone's writing this. I don't know what I thought. Maybe the actor just made it up. I don't know. But it wasn't until I got into college and I took a screenwriting elective, actually, that I learned, I can do this, you know, even though I'd always been a writer my whole life. I never really wanted to write novels. I always wrote short stories and sort of shorter form content. And, you know, being a short story writer is like not really a job. It's really hard to get short stories published unless you're already like an author, essentially. And so I knew I didn't want to write novels. And so when I discovered screenwriting, I'm like, oh, this is perfect. Like, this is a short sort of way that I can get all my ideas out, and it doesn't have to be in novel form. So I think taking that screenwriting elective in college definitely is what showed me that I could do this as a career path.
Also, you majored in political science. Did that lend to anything in your screenwriting world?
I mean, I thought I wanted to be a lawyer. So like I was all set to go to law school. And then I had an internship actually at Fox doing entertainment law. And it was like the most boring thing I've ever done in my life. Like, I hated it every day. The only time that I actually had a fun time is when I would go down to the lot. I had to go down to the lot a lot to get signatures, deliver contracts or whatever. And I think that actually is what sparked my love, because I had so much fun being on the lot. I was like, oh, maybe I should learn more about this. And that sort of led me to take the screenwriting elective, and then which led me to like it. But it wasn't a direct path. Like you said, I was a poli sci major. I graduated. Even though I'd taken that elective, I wasn't going to change my major, because I was like a junior in my second semester and I'm trying to get out of college, not be there any longer. So I did think about going to film school, but I graduated like at the height of the recession in 2009. And the dean of the film school was like, you know, I can't in good conscience tell you to apply to school right now. Like, it costs a lot of money. If you have money, cool. But if you don't have money, like, all you have to do is really work on your craft and network with people. But that's what he told me. And so I worked on my craft. I just worked on screenplays as a hobby in my spare time. I would write scripts, but not really the networking part. I didn't know anyone that was in the entertainment industry, and I didn't even know how you would meet these people. Even though I'm from LA, like, I'm from very regular you know, regular people. Like, my family works at the DWP, not like on movie sets. So I didn't really know what to do until years later. I became a graphic designer and I met a friend of mine. She wanted to be a writer at the company that I was working at. And so she's the one that sort of told me, like, oh, you can become a writer's assistant. You can do there these network fellowships you can apply for. She sort of told me, oh, all the things that made it seem more tangible, like, oh, this doesn't just have to be a hobby. I can make this a career.
I love that story because it's so true, especially in LA. Like, the proximity of the entertainment industry is right in your face all the time. But to get in, there's it could take years. It could take, you could be across the street from a studio and be like, oh, yes. So I understand that. And I think that's true. Like, to just to stay motivated to continue creating in the in between times, right? So I love that you shared that. So the writer's strike, I know I'm jumping to that because it's still affecting a lot of us in the industry. Did that affect you at all, or your plans, or as a producer?
Yeah, I mean, I was on The Witcher. The room was open before the strike. So the strike made me not be able to go to work. But then I think I actually feel fortunate because I did have a job. So when the strike ended, I just went back to the job that I had already. But that wasn't the case for many people. A lot of shows got canceled during the strike, and post-strike we're seeing a big contraction in content being made. So it's much more difficult to find a job now. I don't think that's because of the strike. I think that there was just too much content being made. If you look at the numbers, in 2023, there was almost 600 shows being made. I think in 2000, there was only like 190-ish shows being made. So it's just a huge explosion and proliferation of content being made because of streamers, because of all these new cable networks. And I just think it was unsustainable. I think the strike sort of hastened that and made the downfall become quicker, but I don't think it was caused by the strike.
That's a very, that's a really unique insight that I don't think a lot of us hear. Because if you read the articles, of course, it's true. The contraction, it does affect us, but it was already because of pre-existing conditions. Yeah. And so that's, thank you for sharing that. So what did you learn about, like, as your journey started off in screenwriting and now you're at Netflix with The Witcher and The Sirens of the Deep, how did you initially get into that? If you could share with some emerging screenwriters, like,
oh, writing the movie?
Yes.
Actually, I was an assistant on The Witcher. I got the movie before I got staffed on The Witcher, actually. So season two of The Witcher, I was a script coordinator. And between seasons two and three, my boss just asked me if I wanted to write this movie, co-write the movie with Mike Ostrowski, who is an executive producer on The Witcher as well, and a great writer. So unfortunately, I have no crazy insight as to that. I already worked on the show, and my boss liked my writing. She knew I had experience writing animated content. I had made an animated web series a few years ago, and my boss enjoyed that. She knew I enjoyed animation, so she just asked if I wanted to co-write that with another writer on the show.
No, incredible, because she obviously saw your talent, your potential, and working with you, you had built that rapport and that relationship, so why not? And I think that's an important point to highlight as well. Someone who's worked in collaboration and in community on set, what would you tell someone is the most important thing when you're starting off in a new gig or a new project as a writer or a producer? What do you think is the most important trait? Like, what do you look for if you were looking to hire an assistant or someone or crewing up?
Yes, I think emotional intelligence is key. I think that is more important than your skills, to be honest. And what I mean by emotional intelligence is, you know, having empathy for people, being able to anticipate people's needs, knowing when is the right time to speak, when's the right time to hold back, being kind to people. I feel like people don't understand that skills like that are very important, because you could be the most talented person in the world, but if you are rude, abrasive, horrible, and just a mean person, nobody will really want to be around you. And I think I'm very fortunate that we're in a time where the culture is shifting. I think before, it used to be very commonplace to have like horrible bosses, essentially. Like I would hear these like just nightmare stories about abusive situations where people are throwing things at other writers or their assistants and just berating people. And that was sort of okay. I don't understand why that was okay. I think the entertainment industry is basically one of the only industries I see where poor behavior is rewarded, whereas like any other company you worked for, if that stuff was happening, HR would, you'd be out the door. But I think there's a shift now where like people will call you out. Like we had the Me Too movement, but not just about sexual abuse. I think there's just verbal abuse, horrible behavior, and that stuff is sort of fading away and not becoming acceptable. So I think being a human being who is kind, empathetic, hardworking, those things are a skill that you need to focus on.
I totally 100% agree with you that it's so much energy is conserved if you have the right team and all the focus can go on the final product and the creative product of the project. So yes, you don't want to be an emotional draining person on the project by yeah. any means. Okay. So our final point on in this, our first segment. So tell me about your first animated series, and now tell me about The Witcher, Sirens of the Deep, and how they kind of came full circle for you, or where do you fit in from that first animated series to now?
Yeah, so the first one I co-created with my friend Julissa Wilson, and it's called Julissa Who. And Julissa also does the voice of the main character. And it's sort of about her misadventures. Julissa, she's a character that's always broke. She's always involved in some sort of calamity is going on, whether she's getting fired from work or, you know, she has a bad date. She owes people money and they're coming after her. She's always just doesn't have it together, and her life is constantly crumbling. So we wrote this on basically zero budget. I was still an assistant at the time. I was only making like less than $15 an hour. Julissa didn't have much money, and so we couldn't afford to do a big production. It was sort of like, where can we find the cheapest animator? And we found one on Fiverr.com, and he charged $100 a minute per animation. So we're like, okay, we're going to make 1 minute episodes because that's all we can afford. So that first season, we were just making 1 minute, like it was basically just joke setups and punchlines because that's all you can really do in a minute. And we did that. And to now on The Witcher, having like an entire studio. We worked with incredible Studio Mir out of South Korea, who has been amazing, and just being able to go from no budget to having like a whole team of people and having concept art meetings and just being able to really see your ideas come to fruition full scale. It's been very gratifying.
No, congratulations on that. I'm excited to definitely I'm also kind of assisting on a few animation projects. So I think what I love to see is just like women in the animation space as well. You know, I think that's important. So looking forward to checking out The Witcher. And is there somewhere where we can see your earlier works in animation?
Or do you have it somewhere? Actually, no. Right now we are trying to develop it into a half hour pilot. So the agreement that we have with the producer is that we sort of had to take it. It's not really down, but it's all like behind a password and stuff because we're trying to develop it right now. So you cannot watch it, unfortunately. But no. It'll be a whole show, and you can watch it then.
Yeah, I will. I will. I find animation to be multi-generational, and it appeals to everyone. It brings families together, and also there's so much different ways to create. Obviously The Witcher is its own genre of animation, but beyond that, just how the stories you tell and how you bring in your creative as a director, as someone with like graphic design and design background, like how fulfilling is that for you? Do you work with the storyboard artists or the visual effects team? I mean, how do you find that experience?
It was actually my design background, and I used to do illustration too, was crucial because I was able to pull a lot of references and speak in more of a visual language that I don't think that my co-writer, he didn't necessarily have because he didn't go to art school and doesn't know how to talk about these things. So I think it was really helpful that, you know, for like, I remember one scene, for example, it just felt very dull because everything was sort of monochromatic and like blues. Everything was just shades of blue. And I could say, oh, you know, blah, blah, blah. It needs some contrast. I could say these things because I know about art. So that was cool. And like I said, pulling reference images and doing all of that, I felt really fulfilled on The Witcher as a writer because, you know, I'm not the showrunner. There's a team of writers. So a lot of things get changed from my initial draft of the episode to what you see on TV. There's going to be so many edits. But for the animated film, it's basically what we wrote is what ended up on screen, and also because I'm a producer of that as well, so it was just really great to see.
I love that. Very important point to note is that visual to communicate visual design, that language, I think that's a great tool for emerging storytellers or directors. Animation, to communicate design is very important. So that's something that you had already invested in because you were a graphic designer. But for someone who's not there yet, that could be the first step. Like, how do you compose that? What is composition, color theory, using that language? It's important because, you should be able to communicate why you like something or don't like something, you know, on every project. So thank you for highlighting that. Very important. Great. We're going to move on to our second segment because you are a founder of a very important community called In The Cut that has helped so many creatives like myself. Why did you create it, Ray?
I created it because I wish something had existed like that when I first got started. So I started In The Cut when I was still an assistant. I was a writer's assistant on the first season of Bridgerton. And I feel like just from becoming an assistant, I learned so much and I had access to all of these people that I could share that information with others. And that's another point that I want to make. I think a lot of times we think that we have to wait until we're some famous person or you know, I have to wait till I'm Shonda Rhimes to be able to start something and give back. No, like whatever information that you have, you probably have more information than the next person. So I started this when I was still an assistant because I had access to writers, to other assistants, to producers, and I was able to start In The Cut. It started initially as live events, and the pandemic sort of killed that dream, but it turned out to be a blessing in disguise because through the virtual events, we were able to reach way more people than like the little 50-person live events that I was doing before the pandemic. And I just started it, like I said, because I wish something had existed like that for me because I was confused and didn't know where to start. And I think that there are there are not enough platforms that give people just real information. I feel like there's a lot of platforms that teach writing, and we do that occasionally. We do have writing classes, but I feel like all my content is geared more towards actual getting people jobs, not just teaching people stuff.
No, I think that's incredibly generous of you to start that, because I think something, and this is just my opinion, a lot of people in the industry, we're all on the same path, but not a lot of people extend that reach, that they don't share that with the world right away. Like you said, they might wait till, well, once I've made it to this level. The fact that you're like, you know what, I'm building this as I'm also building my career. Let's all get in this together. Let's share the resources. Really, applause to you on that, because I think it comes from a very genuine altruistic place, which I do think is the heart of a really great organization, is having that empathy, which you've also mentioned, emotional intelligence and empathy. So that's very much one of your core personalities, and I appreciate that, because how many people has it affected? I know for me, I've attended a few of your events. I saw your writer's retreat in Palm Springs, and I was like, I wish I could attend that, but I didn't, but maybe next time. I know personally for me, I've attended a few of them, and I really appreciated the insight and an amazing guest that you bring on. Like I said, we need more gate openers, door openers, connectors in the community than gatekeepers. And I think that's great. But has anyone told you personally, like from the community, like how that you've helped them or the organization? What is like some insights or feedback that you get from your community?
Yeah, I mean, just on a macro level, we've had probably close to 150-ish events, whether live and in person, and it's been attended by thousands of people. At last I checked, these numbers are probably off. I think it was around 11,000 people, and just on a personal level, I know people have gotten jobs because of the In the Cut. I did a free show support initiative, which was a free class for writers assistants, showrunners assistants, and writers PAs that linked to like a database that I created, which employers could then access. I know several people have gotten jobs. One girl reached out to me and said she got a job as to be the writer's PA on The Penguin show on HBO. I know people have gotten jobs on Grey's Anatomy, other shows because of that. So that's just, very fulfilling to see that, you know, people can do that.
No, I love that. And you have a really robust online community as well, where you share for subscribers and members just insights and events, and people are able to communicate and network with each other as well, which I think truly, a good sign of a good online community is if the community members are interacting with each other. Otherwise, it's like a dead space, right? You can create a channel, a curated community, and then no one's interacting. And you're like, well, what's the point? We have everyone in here, but there's no dialogue. But yours is very much active, and there's a lot of promotion and people just connecting over projects, which I find it to be one of the tenets of a really great thriving community. So kudos to that. What essential traits or practices or skills do you think a founder has to implement to support a thriving or starting a community or thriving community or sustaining it, in your opinion?
I think flexibility, because things are constantly changing. Like I said, I went from doing live events to having to do virtual events because of the pandemic. Now, I could have just shut my whole business down. Like, I didn't know anything about webinars. I didn't know anything about doing online events, but I quickly pivoted and quickly learned so that I could just serve people rapidly. So I think flexibility, I'm willing to just see what's working and what's not working and quickly adapt. I would also say openness. I think a lot of times I try to make myself open to people. I've actually had to scale back because I think I was being too open and it wasn't serving the person or me, because I was just like overwhelmed with things, but I still am open. Like, if anyone has a question, you can always DM at inthecutla.org, email me, and I will respond. I'm just probably not going to meet every person in real life or read every person's script because I just don't have time to do that anymore. But if you have just like a question, I always respond to questions. So being open and leading with authenticity, I think you have to do in building a community, because it's one thing to say like, oh, I'm going to help people and be some sort of figurehead. But if you're not actually having a dialogue with people, it's not really helpful. And then I would say being consistent is the key to anything, really. Writing, having a company, you can't just do something one time. And like, I can't write one script and call myself a writer, even if that script is terrific. It's one thing. So you always have to be constantly doing more and improving more.
Consistency, yes. That powerhouse, superpower skill and trait, like just iterating, reiterating, and getting better with every project, with every meeting, with everything. I love that. Absolutely. What were some earlier pain points that you think you overcame from the beginning of Indicut to now where you're at now?
I would say the earliest pain points were just trying to find venues. So like I said, I was doing live events, and when you're doing live events, I still do them occasionally, but not as frequently as I did, because it just adds a whole nother element to having to find venues, to having to worry about parking, to having to worry about all the logistics that goes with a live event that you don't have to really deal with virtually. And when I do have live events now, I like to have someone help me. So I feel like delegating is a skill that, you know, we all have to learn. I'm not good at everything. There are things that I'm really bad at. And when you're first starting out, you kind of have to do everything because you don't really have the resources. At least I didn't have the resources to hire other people or to get help. But now that I have been in a place where now we're going to go into the fifth year of In the Cut in 2025. We started in January of 2020. So I can have other people help me, like at my retreat, plenty of my writer's retreat, even though it's fun, it's also very stressful to me just coordinating all of that. The last 2 years, I was able to have like an assistant and a event planner just helped me out with all of that, and it's just made my life exponentially easier. So I think, you know, delegation is one thing that comes with time.
Wonderful. Just for our listeners, how was can you share a little bit about your writer's retreat and how it turned out?
Yeah, so I've been doing this retreat. This was the third year that I've done it. So the first year we started, it was only like 8 people, and it sold out in like an hour. I didn't think it would sell out that quickly. So I booked like a very small resort. It was my first time and there weren't that many rooms. So the second year I wanted to open it up. And we had about 25 people the second year. And then this third year, we went down a little bit to about 15. And I think that's a good number because I want to keep it small enough where I get to interact with everyone and it doesn't seem overwhelming. But basically, the Writers Retreat is an event that I do every year where writers of all skill levels can come. They can network and fellowship with each other, set aside time for themselves to write, and then also attend workshops and panels led by myself and other professional writers in the industry. So this year we had Lauren Glover, who's a producer. She's working on Chicago Med right now, but she's also worked on shows like Nancy Drew on the CW, Duster, which is supposed to be on HBO. I don't know if that show is ever going to come out, but it's a J.J. Abrams show that was supposed to be on HBO and other shows. And she's just very experienced, very great writer. And then we had also Kyra Talese, who's worked on Insecure, Black Lady Sketch Show, amongst other shows. And yeah, it was a great experience. Every year, to me, the biggest testament to that experience is that we have people coming back every year. So like last year, there was about, out of the 15 people, I think 6 or 7, actually, I think it might have been more than that. It might have been like 10 people were repeat attendees. And there's a couple people that have been every year, all 3 years. So to me, that's the greatest sort of feedback I can get, is that people just keep coming back.
No, that is wonderful. And I really do hope I can attend the next one, hopefully, because it seems like, yeah, from people's experiences and from what you just shared, it's a high value retreat. Like, you get to fellowship. That is the word. I think sometimes fellowship is what I feel, community is what I feel keeps people in the creative industry motivated. And sharing these stories, like you said, just in our interview so far, the pain points of either being a founder or the starting up to be before you came to The Witcher or Netflix, how you started, is so important to listen to one another's like origin stories and their journeys. Cause I think that fuels a lot of our why and it motivates us. So I do think when you create a container and a space for that, where people are open and vulnerable and also learning while also, and you know, being in community, I think it's a very essential for creatives and writers. So thank you for creating that space, because yes, we need more spaces like that for sure. Ray, what are your future goals with In the Cut? How do you want to grow it, and what are your goals? I know it's entering into the fifth year, so amazing, but what do you want to do with In the Cut?
I would like to make more pre-recorded content, like a masterclass style. Like, I want to be like the masterclass of screenwriting and filmmaking only, like none of the other stuff. You know, masterclass has great classes, I recommend them, but just like a hub where people can access content at any time, because as you know, I get busy with work. Like, In the Cut is not my job. Like, I'm a writer, and it's really hard to sustain when I have to be in a writer's room all day writing scripts. Now I have a son. So I just want to be able to have a place where people can go and access content without me having to do live webinars all the time. And then I would still like to do more in-person events, but make it sort of special. So, you know, like the Writer's Retreat, I did a great event with NBC Launch Universal a couple weeks ago, where we had a panel on the Universal lot and had writers come in and meet with alumni of the NBCU fellowship and the director of the program, meet with each other. Like, I want to do live events, but like have them be, you know, something very curated, special, and worth going to. And then people can access the other content on, you know, my website.
No, excellent. And I see that happening, because you have built so much value for your community by bringing these like educational, impactful events. And also there's a content library right now in your community, yes, too, where people can access like previous events. So I think that is definitely a great thing to hear, because education is so important for anyone. And I also agree that you don't always need to go down the road of a traditional school or university, but you definitely need an education and community and production experience to understand it. So yeah, so wealth of information and In the Cut. So thank you. Well, we are now going to shift to our third segment, Ray, Future of Entertainment and the Role Storytellers Play in Society. How important is storytelling now and then obviously in the future?
Yeah, it's funny because I was actually listening to a podcast right before this, The Town, which is a great podcast if you're interested in the entertainment industry to listen to. But they had the head of FX on there, John Landgraf, and he was talking about how sort of our cultural, there's been a huge cultural shift where TV and film were sort of the standard of culture. That was sort of our fireplace. We'd all gather around and we'd watch the same TV shows, we'd watch the same movies, and people would quote movies and TV shows all the time. I remember that was a thing. You're saying like that doesn't exist anymore. People like quote memes now, and that the internet is sort of the culture, and the internet is not a monoculture. Really, the algorithms serve you whatever you want to see. So you can be very siloed in one worldview as opposed to having just the same reference point on cultural touchstones. So I think that storytelling has changed a lot. In the future, I hope that it still exists. I don't know, this is going to sound very bleak, but I feel like meme culture, sort of influencer culture, I think has devalued storytelling a lot. Or on the flip side, maybe it's valued it more because it's now become rarer to see something that is quality, that I think that those things that are quality, maybe they push further through the culture. So I can, you know, I don't want to be bleak. I feel like you can look at it either way. But I do think that it will always have a place. I think that that's what humanity is at its core, storytelling, whether, you know, your parents are telling you a story about how they first met. Like, that's how we relate to one another as humans. So I think it will always exist. Now, whether that exists in TV format, I don't know. I hope it does, though.
No, you're right. And that's a really good reflected point, because either A, it will, like, the greater stories will emerge to the top because the influencer meme culture is so ubiquitous. There's so much of it. So you kind of have to churn through it and find, like, the golden nuggets of, like, oh, that's unique. I haven't come across that. But a lot of stuff right now, because of the accessibility, is very copy and paste. And it, I feel that it's really nice when you come across somewhat original, authentic work, and you can tell a writer's voice or even a director's or a producer's viewpoint. You can see how they've kind of emerged from the rest of it, because it's very easy, I guess. I think, oh, this is another question. It wasn't on my list, but do you find like you have to consume as much as you create? Or equal or not? Because, yes, let me ask you that.
That's first. A good question. You know, I was saying to my boyfriend the other day, like, I always feel really bad if I'm on, like, Instagram and just scrolling for hours. It, like, makes me feel bad about myself. Like, I've wasted a whole day. But then if I watch TV the whole day, I don't feel bad. And I was like, why does it feel that way? And he was like, well, you know what? For you, watching TV is, like, work. It's not like you're mindlessly scrolling, like you're watching something and you're learning, like you're you write TV. So when you watch TV, you're learning something about structure or character or something, and it's influencing you. I'm like, you're right. Like, because I don't feel sort of disgusted with myself in the same way when I watch TV a lot. So I do think that it helps, like, for instance, right now, I'm watching Sex and the City. I've never watched that show. I know I'm 20 years late, but I never watched Sex and the City during the original run. And I decided, oh, let me watch this. And I think the first two seasons of that show are just so well structured and well written. And it actually helped me break a structural problem in a show that I'm developing that has nothing to do with Sex and the City. It's not the same tone at all, completely different premise, but the way that they structured sort of thematic episodes helped me solve a story problem. So I think that it is important to consume. Like, I've met people that say they're TV writers and don't watch TV, and like, you can't do that. Like, literally every single meeting you have, they're going to ask you, what are you watching? And if you can't answer that question, it's also a way to gauge your taste. You sort of have to partake in the arena to know what your tastes are and to know what's happening. That's like saying, you know, I am a novelist, but I've never read a book. Like, you wouldn't say that. That doesn't make any sense. So if you want to be a TV writer, a film writer, you have to be consuming what's out there.
Very, very important advice to people who want to take this industry seriously or want to be taken seriously as well. Because you're right. If you're not on the set learning production, what are you producing? You have to know the world you're creating in. So very important, very important. What are your thoughts about the age of AI that we're in? It's been generative AI last 18 months. And of course, just recently, Lionsgate partnered with Runway. Yes, and now there's an AI film festival and so much. And just in the last year, so many AI screenwriting platforms and apps. And of course, already video, text to video, and image generating apps. But what are your thoughts? Like, just as a creative, what do you feel about AI right
now? I am not an anti-AI person. I've used ChatGPT before. I feel like AI, I think, can help with mundane tasks. I will quote two things. Like, another great podcast is Script Notes from Craig Mazin and John August. And they had an episode where they were discussing how they use AI to, like, generate something. Like, they needed basically a synopsis of some episodes. So they said, oh, ChatGPT, can you go through this whole archive and pull up this episode? Now, that saved them hours of time. So their whole premise, their whole sort of ethos is like, use AI for things that a human could do, but it would just be a tedious task, sort of like a calculator. No one's anti-calculator. No one's saying, like, oh, add up all that stuff by hand. No, I'm going to use a calculator because it's quicker. Same with AI. You can use it in that sort of realm. And he's like, as a writer, for research purposes, sometimes you have to do a lot of research depending on what you're writing. If you're writing something historical, medical related, crime related, you have to do a lot of research that takes up a lot of time. ChatGPT could do that for you and give it to you quicker. I also heard Will.i.am say something very interesting on a podcast. He's very, if you don't know Will.i.am, in addition to being a singer, is like very into the tech space. He has a tech company and I think an AI company. And he was saying how, like, in the music realm, like, there, I guess there's some AI where you could, we've all seen these, like, sort of AI songs that come out, and he was excited about this as a musician, not horrified. And he was like, I just think of it as another tool to unlock creativity. Think about it like when GarageBand came out. Everyone was making songs on their computer and getting excited. Now you can make a song and you don't have to actually play an instrument. Is that bad or is that good? For him, he's like, I'm a producer. This was good when they made, you know, NPCs or digital sort of musician tools, because now you've opened up access for people to expand their creativity more. You're not actually, I think a lot of us are fearful that it's going to replace creativity, but I think if you use it in the right way, it can just enhance your creativity and make you be able to output at a faster level. So I feel like, you know, AI is coming. We can't say don't use this. I think, sure, would that be cool to say? Yeah, but I think that's sort of an archaic sort of way of thinking. That's like saying, oh, the camera was invented. All the painters are going to not exist. Painting still exists, you know? So I don't think it has to be this either or, because this exists, none of this can exist. I think it can coexist.
No, absolutely. And not to speak in absolutes, because yes, it doesn't have to be all bad or all good. I think it's how we implement the tools. And I think it would serve all of us, especially people, our community members or creatives that are working on a budget. Like if we can reduce our budget, we can reduce our time, we can create more. And yes, I think if you can master the tools, then you can then use them and implement your bigger vision that way. So it's not a bad thing. So I guess the thing would be like either just like you said, the digital camera. Before that, people were using motion picture. Now there's videography. It made it easier and accessible, but you still need to know how to use the camera, know composition, lighting, how to still tell a great story. So I think what would serve us would be like, hey, let's learn the tools. It's just like learning another software app. Just learn the tools and start implementing them into your production pipeline and your world building, as to say. But great. What kind of stories do you want to see more? And is there a project that would be your ideal project you like to work on?
Yeah, I want to see just more lighthearted comedy stories. I feel like, no, the world is bleak enough. I just want to laugh. I think that's why shows like Abbott Elementary are so popular right now, because there hasn't been a show like that in a while that is a comedy and is actually a comedy. It's not a drama in 30 minutes, which I think there's a lot of these like not really comedies that are just 30 minutes. So I would like to see more just broad comedies. There's a reason why people keep rewatching The Office 20 years later, Friends, Seinfeld, all these shows. And I think that's what people are craving. And I would love to work on Abbott Elementary or create, you know, my own show that's in that vein of just like a traditional sitcom, but doesn't feel sort of old. It still feels fresh.
I love that. Well, Abbott Elementary, we might see an episode. Hopefully, let's put it out there. That would be wonderful. That would be wonderful. And I totally see that happening. Why not? Mm-hmm. Okay, right. We so enjoyed your conversation. We have a final segment. It's called Listen, Reflect, and Connect. So I'm just going to ask you some reflective questions before we say goodbye. How can we all be better community members on this spaceship we call Earth?
Empathy. I'm gonna bring it back to that. Just stop thinking about yourself. Like, you're really not that important. That sounds harsh, but everyone thinks they're the most important person. Everyone's having a rough time. Everyone had something happen to them that you don't know about. So sort of just put yourself in other people's shoes and show grace to people and understanding, forgiveness, and you know. That's my advice.
As a mother and a creator, what is one thing you hold dear to your heart when you're producing or creating? Any advice to parents in the industry?
Yeah, I would say don't be so hard on yourself. Before I had kids, I have a friend of mine that has two kids. And this was a few years ago, and she would sort of be down upon herself because she would be like, you know, I see you making all this stuff. We had one friend that challenged herself to write a script every week. Like, that's an insane amount of output. She's like, I feel bad because I'm not doing all these things. I have two kids. I work full time, blah, blah, blah. Like, and I told her, don't compare yourself to people that don't have the same amount of responsibility as you do. So that would be my advice, is that don't compare yourself to people that aren't in your shoes, that are able to work 24/7, stay up till 2 a.m. and do stuff. If you have a child, you probably can't do that, and that's okay. So plan, schedule, prioritize, but know that you might have a little less time to do things, and that's okay.
Final question. Where do you see yourself in 10 years?
10 years, hopefully I have some shows that I've created on the air. You know, I would like to have my own studio, production company. owning stuff, making stuff in the cut is at the masterclass level, and I'm kicking back on an island on vacation or something.
Well, I see that happening. I think you have been such a generous community member and helped so many creatives. I see that, you know, I see that happening for you. I totally do. And I love that you shared all these amazing insights from your career in television to now writing animation feature films as well and doing all these wonderful things. So I thank you, Ray, for joining us today and sharing this with us. And I hope our listeners listen to this podcast and get all this and absorb all this wisdom from you, because I think very important things were said about being a good community member, being going after your dreams, not setting back, that growth mindset, all these things attribute to success. And it's that mindset. So I appreciate you for creating that space for us and joining us today. So thank you.
Thank you for having me, Farida. It was a great conversation, and wishing you all the success and the best with your podcast, and keep it up, keep going.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed The Slow Dive, please subscribe and leave us a positive review wherever you get your podcasts. The Slow Dive is hosted by Farida Rafiq, edited by Drew Franzblatt. Our theme song is Dive by Sarah. Thanks for listening.